It's Halloween. You know, we came in costumes. Some folks came in frivolous costumes. Some folks are in, you know, my deep true nature kind of costumes. But I was listening the other day to a conversation, to a podcast. It was actually on the Ezra Klein show, talking about right-wing extremism in the United States. And I was talking about online subcultures where there's a social function in which people will joke about something that's transgressive and will use joking about it as, in a way, the cover for expressing really horrible views, you know. So who will use like blatantly anti-Semitic or racist language, fascistic language, but use it in a kind of hyper-ironic, jokey way, so that when they get, you know, called out on it, and in a way, they can say like, "You don't understand it. Like, it was a joke. Like, that's how we are in that online subculture. It's joking." And that one of the far right-wing leaders in the United States, Nick Fuentes, actually put out an instruction to people to say, you know, say the thing you really mean, but say it in a funny way, or in a like hyper exaggerated way, so that you always have cover for it, because it could always be just like, you know, you were just joking, like no one would ever really say that, but you are really saying it. And so then the conversation was really about how there are these subcultures where you start out just being kind of provocative and edgy in order to gain social capital, in order to, you know, kind of, you know, be kind of transgressive, you know, in a way that's initially sort of fun. But that there starts to be this slippage where gradually it slides from being like self-conscious, ironic humor. Like, I don't really believe that, I'm just saying it to like be edgy and, you know, like, into like, you start to really believe the thing that you're saying, right? So it starts off as a kind of costume. This is the theme for tonight, right? It starts off as a kind of edgy pretend thing, and then it starts to slide into like, you know, no, you actually just feel that way. Like, you're saying it as an exaggeration because it's more socially acceptable that way, but actually what you're doing is also revealing, you know, a socially unacceptable opinion or persona or identity. And so that got me thinking a bit about costumes. And, you know, also in my small, you know, it's my small town Halloween here, in the various sort of, you know, trick-or-treaty kind of small town events that have been happening, you know, over the last bunch of days, you know, there's lots of innocuous costumes. People are animals, or, you know, kind of funny, you know, rainbow unicorns and sort of funny figures and things like that. And people are media characters, and, you know, there was like at least three like whole Wizard of Oz groups around this sort of Occidental Halloween parade. And, you know, like one would pass on one side of the street and a different woman would come up, and you know, so, you know, relatively innocuous. But then, you know, particularly in the tween space, you know, there are a bunch of kids who were obviously kind of right on the cusp of, you know, no longer being like little kids wearing, you know, dressed up like elves, like my kid, and not yet teenagers, but they've sort of arrived in the sexy goth transgressive kind of costume space. And I saw a few where it was I saw a few that to be honest just made me really uncomfortable, actually, where I was like, oh, you're like 10, but you're dressed like a hypersexualized mass murdering psychopath, from a movie or something. And I'm like, I get that there's a sort of coolness and there's like a sort of fun, like it is kind of transgressive. You've got blood dripping down your face and your baseball bat. But I'm like, you know nothing about what's going on in the world right now, and that lots of us don't want to see anything like this. I know, I'm boring, conservative, anti-media parent. Yes. My kid is at Waldorf. And a way that part of what I would see is, and that got me thinking about talking about this tonight was that, I notice for myself, and my kids are doing this, and I notice in the various people that when you wear a costume for Halloween or for whatever, in order for that costume to really work in a certain way, you have to behave like it a little bit. So you have to act a little bit like the thing. And you don't have to, of course. You could be totally dressed like a serial killer, but just like skipping around and laughing. But I didn't see that very much. What I would see is that the people dressed like something, they would even just a little tiny bit of a way, they would put it on. They would make a kind of like ah sort of face, whatever it is. And so here's the, here's the thesis, the sort of the Buddhist, link here, is that like, yes, there's an understanding in the Dharma that social identities, social roles, for the Buddha, it was like the roles of the caste system that were thought of as being so solid by the culture around him, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaisyas, the Sudras. You might be more familiar with the Sanskrit versions of those words, Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, the four castes. They were beginning to solidify in the time of the Buddha. And the Buddha would have conversations with Brahmins who would say, birth makes a Brahmin. And the Buddha would say, if you have a Brahmin that acts ethically and a Brahmin that acts ethically, which one of them is more a Brahmin? And the Brahmin would say, like, well, the one that acts ethically. And the Buddha would sort of corner them into admitting that it can't be birth or family or wealth or social position that makes one a Brahmin. They have to end up admitting that it's ethical action that makes one a Brahmin. And so the Buddha's punchline all the time in relation to all sorts of identities is that the thing that matters is your actions, not the identity, not the social role. And I you see the same thing in the way that he admitted women into the Sangha, which was radical to do at the time. He was the first or second in all of the Indian subcontinent, spiritual systems that we know of to admit women into monastic orders. The other was the Jains. Honor to them for also doing that. They were rival sects in the same place at the same time, so they influenced each other. But his reasoning for admitting women into the order, he was hesitant, the texts tell us at first, I think partly because it might be dangerous, but the argument was, Ananda said this, Blessed One, is it not true that women have, just as absolutely can achieve full liberation? Like, are they completely capable of achieving full liberation? And the Buddha doesn't hesitate at all. He says, of course they are. Ananda says, then it's right to admit them, to give them the chance to pursue that fully. Because you've said the monastic lifestyle is the best way to pursue full liberation. It's the most skillful, supportive path. And here's a whole, group of people who are absolutely capable of achieving that liberation, the most skillful path then should be available to them. It's rock solid logic the Buddha has to concede, and he does. And we can read this in part as coming down to, you know, that what matters is not the social identity. In other words, what it meant at that time to be, you know, a woman, or to be in a woman's body, to be in a female body. All of those social constructions made life as an ordained woman harder, but they weren't ultimately determinative. And actually, none of the social roles are ultimately determinative. And so we can understand from this that, you know, the presentation we carry through the world, whatever it is a kind of costume, is a kind of mask. You know, I'm performing as, you know, the good father, or the, you know, or the you know, politically active good citizen, or, you know, or the kind friend, or the, you know, whatever it is, all the different roles, right? And we have to see at some point, you know, this is, right, in the teaching on selflessness, anatta, the teaching really is not that there's not a self or a soul in beings, but it's that there's no particular experience that you can identify as being mine, I or mine. So I say, like, oh, the conscientious dad, which is a role I try to fulfill, you know, to varying degrees of success, depending on who you ask. Can I say that that's myself? You know, well, if it is, then myself only appeared, you know, 7.5 years ago, and before that, that wasn't myself. And anyway, what about the days when I'm not conscientious, or when I forget to try to be conscientious? Is it still myself? You know, when I'm asleep and I forget that I'm a dad, like last night, I was dreaming, and in my dream, there was totally other people, and my family wasn't there, and I had no consciousness of being a father last night in my dream. Was that then not myself? You know, was I not there somehow? You know, there's so many ways that we can see that the roles that we carry or play out in our lives, they are, you know, they're appropriate and hopefully skillful, you know, temporary conditioned fictions. You know, it's appropriate for me to play the role of the father, or the role of the teacher, or the role of the whatever it is at different times. And it's appropriate to put those roles down sometimes, you know. And so, what happens with costumes, right? To get back to, you know, pretending, you put on a costume and you have to act like it a bit, right? So hopefully you're putting on wholesome costumes, right? I hope that conscientious, right, is my attempt to make the father costume a wholesome one, right? And I remind myself, you know, not to be an unwholesome dad, right? So there's practice there. There's ethical practice everywhere, always wise action. Try to keep the precepts. And if you're keeping your precepts in mind every day, because, you know, every day there's opportunities to slip up, part of what you're doing is you're working to make the costume that you're wearing a wholesome one, you know. And I think there's traditionally in the Dharma, it's often seen in a way that in the training there's kind of two kinds of work. One is the work to improve the situation that you're in, to make things be as safe and kind and marked with compassion and wholesome and helpful as you can. That work is not in and of itself liberatory, but it's necessary. Because the mind, when it's not protected by ethical action, is impossible to concentrate. It's impossible to see clearly. There's too many, the clouds, the demons of your own bad karma are too present. If you're just going around lying and cheating and stealing and, you know, causing harm, it haunts the inner world. There's no way to rest at peace. And without being able to rest at peace, you can't enter jhana, you can't see clearly in vipassana. So ethics is the training, sila, the training of in virtue, is the protective mechanism. You have to protect yourself from the results of unskillful action. Then the liberating side that is supported by that is the side that rides that protected field of action into clear states of the heart and mind. So sila unfolds as samadhi. Sila is like, protect yourself. Make whatever costume you're wearing, make it as wholesome as you can. Maybe that means you avoid unwholesome costumes, right? Like maybe I'm like, almost certainly, like I am never going to dress as a serial killer on Halloween. I don't want to. Nothing in me wants to do that. To further that archetype in the world and put it on? I don't want to put that on. I have no desire to wear that persona, because at some point, even if I'm totally joking, I'm going to have to like wave the machete around for the photo and be like, ah, you know, like, no, thank you. Right. But like, okay, so here I go. I'm moving through the world and I'm, you know, what's the persona that people see me in various social settings? Here's the teacher, here's the husband, here's the father, here's the whatever it is. Here's the guy at a rave, you know? When I'm at a rave, one of the things that I'm doing is I'm trying to be at the rave in as wholesome a way as I can. Like, I want to be protected. The thing that I'm most scared of, right, is losing my head and like messing up in some way, like wearing an unskillful costume. For my own sake, right? Because when your costume slides into being unskillful, it's because the armies of Mara are close by, close at hand. You know, lust and hatred and fear and delusion are close by. And so your costume then costumes are not inherently wrong. Like, it's just you've got a life, you've got a body, you have to dress it somehow, dress it however you want. Khakis and a t-shirt is a costume. You know, wearing sweats all day is a costume. You know, wearing your super fancy goth outfit is a costume. But when you wear the costume, you have to act like it a little bit sometimes. And if you wear the same costume a lot, you have to act like it a lot. And as you act it more and more, there can be this slippage where it can, at the very least, even if you don't believe it, you know, like you're doing some extreme performance, you don't believe it, but acting it normalizes it a little bit. And I think that we can become, I start to forget. I want to say I start to forget who I really am, but that's a slippery dharma. I can't say that, right? So here's a suggestion. Someone sent me a note privately, so I won't say who it is. It's fine, no problem. Please do that if you ever want to, to speak about like wearing a costume in a certain way as a kind of shadow work. Like, you know, one might address in costumes as a release of what one is afraid of or hiding from or fearful of being. Absolutely, you can totally do it as a kind of That's a kind of like psychological, transmutation. It's a tantric sort of approach to this thing. I think that can work if there's intention, right? If you're really intentionally doing that, I'm putting on the thing that I'm afraid of. You know, I'm going to dress sexy because I'm actually afraid of dressing sexy. So I'm going to use the excuse of Halloween to do this thing that I'm actually afraid of. Or I'm going to dress scary because I've been conditioned to be like a good boy or a good girl or whatever. And wholesome intention makes the costume wholesome. Like that's part of what that does. Maybe you're wearing something horrifying, but you're doing it for a wholesome reason, which is to say you're conscious, right? You're mindful of it in a certain way. So, I'm play acting this in order to contact some energy that is helpful for me to contact. I think that that's a beautiful way to use costume, you know? Of course I want to contact my inner, you know, great brown bear. Like, well, yeah. For wholesome reasons, you know, not because I want to break into people's cars at Yosemite and steal candy, but because bears are awesome and, you know, I want to win Fat Bear Week and, you know, that kind of, you know, anyway, but you get where I'm going, that the mask, that we become the mask if we lose mindfulness, if we lose intention, if we lose why we're doing it. And that when the mind, the heart is well protected by wise action, by ethics, and has actually been trained, allowed to marinate a bit in the profound peacefulness of meditative states, we can start to do the practice of seeing clearly, vipassana, seeing clearly or seeing deeply or seeing with profundity. And the profound seeing of vipassana reveals the conditioned nature of whatever costume we've been wearing. And one of the most powerful things that it can do in the insight realm is that it can show you that the thing that you've thought of all along as your like authentic self is actually just a deeper costume, and you haven't really seen it as a costume before, you know, and that could come up even as like, you know, in some costumes that I've started to believe, like I'm the diligent spiritual seeker. That's a great one. I wore that costume for years. I'm still wearing it. I believe it most days because it's true mostly. And in Vipassana just means, you know, don't accept any narratives as ultimately true. You see the thing, you know, what is the thing? I'm a diligent spiritual seeker. What does that mean? Like, oh, I'm sitting in meditation and I notice that I'm just trying to do it right. Or I have a certain, there's just a thing, there's a subtle energy that I'm missing that I'm not seeing clearly. And it's where it's become a kind of identity. It's part of myself. Sometimes this will happen to me. I'm a professional meditator, right? I'm supposed to meditate and teach other people to meditate. So I sit down to meditate in the morning, and sometimes I don't want to, because who wants to every single day? Maybe you do. You're here because you do. I'm admitting. Some days I don't want to, right? And some days when I don't want to and I do, it feels like a wholesome, simple expression of my dedication to the Dharma. Like, yeah, this is just what I do. I'm going to do it. And other times I do it because I'm a teacher and I'm supposed to. And it's almost like I shame myself into doing it. It's like, what kind of a teacher would you be if you like succumbed to this most basic of hindrances? You know, that's totally Mara, right? Mara comes to the Buddha and says that. The Buddha goes to lay down for some rest. His back is hurting. He says, Ananda, give the Dharma talk. My back is hurting. I'm going to lay down. He goes to lay down. Mara comes and stands in the doorway and says, ooh, blessed one, giving in to laziness, are we? And the Buddha's like, hey, cut it out, Mara. Go away. You know, Mara's like, Mara actually says, like, who's who? oh, who's the awakened one now? The Buddha's going to sleep, right? He was like, who's the awakened one now? Going to sleep, are we? You know? And so when mindfulness is strong and loving kindness is strong, like you're not falling into self-blame and judgment, you can see layers of costume, layers of mask that have been present. Say, oh, there's that story. It's been running my life. You know, very subtly, here it is, right? And that, and you can just say, I see you, Mara. That this beautiful, beautiful phrase from directly from the text. The Buddha says, you know, I see you, Mara. I see you, wicked one, you know. One of the things that's amazing about the Buddha's liberatedness is that he knows he's liberated. Like there's just no doubt, right? And so we could think of this even mythically as like the archetype of the one who is not just free, but who knows they're free. And there's a kind of amazing confidence that's there, you know, that whenever he gets accused of something, so this happens all the time in the texts. Somebody, you know, someone comes to him and says, you know, oh, you know, you Kathiyas, you Kshatriyas, you warrior caste, you're just like this. And the Buddha essentially is like, I know what I am. You can't insult me. Like, you know, like no insults stick to him. And so in mythically, we can just understand this as someone who, maybe in a psychological way, we could say he knows who he is so deeply that any costume someone else tries to project on him, because of course that's the other thing that happens, is that it's not just the costumes I think I'm wearing, but it's the costumes that other people put on me, you know, and try being a teacher. People put things on you all the time, and you have to keep being like, no, that's not me, stop it, you know, don't put that mask on me. But people try to put it on the Buddha, and they're like, oh, you're totally like this. And he's like, no, you don't get it. I'm totally not like that. But part of how he expresses it is he really knows how free he is. And he'll just say it. He'll be like, no, that doesn't stick. That's not me. You know, he doesn't wear any more masks. And so our practice partly can be to take off masks, yes, to see costumes for what they are. You don't necessarily need to take them off. You should actually wear a skillful one forever. Maybe they change, but you know, you should have a skillful, you should have a wardrobe of skillful costumes. You know, go to work wearing a skillful worker costume. Don't wear the wrong costume in the wrong place, right? Don't wear your rave costume to work. Don't wear your work costume to the rave. You know, don't wear your office costume to bed with your sweetheart. Like, it doesn't work, right? You have to wear the appropriate costume. Wear it skillfully. And, you know, and yeah, use them in a way that like, uses the energy that they carry to train the mind in different forms of energies. And sometimes maybe we want to jump to the like take off all the costumes, like unmask part. That's it, because it's such an important part of the practice of really the movement toward liberation. So yes to doing that, right? And it can feel like what we want to do is just jump to the no costume state or knowledge. This is common in Western Buddhism. It's a version of wanting to skip over the ethical limbs and get right to samadhi, or skip over samadhi even and get right to wisdom, panya, right? The triumvirate, the three parts of the Eightfold Path, sila, ethics, samadhi, absorption or meditation, immersion, and panya, wisdom, the insight limbs. You know, modern vipassana in the Goenka and Mahasi styles formally bypasses both sila and samadhi, Right. The Goenka folks will even say, like, don't worry too much about ethical action until your mind has seen clearly, it'll come by itself. I totally don't agree. Worry about ethical action. In the Mahasi system, they're like, don't worry about concentration. You can go straight to insight practice. Just start seeing clearly. Their practice does develop some concentration, so it can work for some people. But for most of us, I think more concentration is helpful than that system provides either. And so if we go with the traditional formulation, which you know I like, sila is there for a reason, which means the costume is there for a reason. It's a training in wise relationship and wise engagement with the world, but it's also a protection. You know, it's a protection against the ways that we can fall off the path. And so wear a skillful costume. Wear a costume that protects you, or that moves energy in a way that's helpful for you. And then while you're in it, train the mind to really manifest its qualities skillfully. And so that's then, you know, the costume is sila in a certain way, and the training of the mind or how we perform in it is samadhi in a certain way. Actually find the pathway to a deep inner clarity supported by the costume. Yeah. It's partly why the monks have a costume. The costume actually supports the tranquility of the mind. The costume isn't just the robes, but it's the whole thing. You know, the whole way of being a monk. It forces the mind into certain grooves. Just trying to follow the bloody schedule forces the mind into certain grooves. And in those grooves, it's easier to settle down, you know. So choose your costumes wisely, and then behave well and beautifully in them, with ultimately the liberation of the heart as the goal. All right, we'll pause there. Yeah.